ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF store and sponsored by iShares. iShares sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. iShares is not affiliated with the ETF store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, great show. As always, I want to thank iShares, the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime. Joining me will be Heather Bell, managing editor for ETF.com, and our resident expert on new ETF launches and filings. Over the past month or so, there have been a number of interesting ETFs that have come to market, and I think everyone knows I love tracking these, so I picked out a handful to discuss with Heather. I'll get her take on those. And then I also want to touch on this big filing from Fidelity. They're going to put their popular Magellan fund into a non-transparent ETF wrapper. Now, that's not the contra fund in a transparent ETF wrapper that I've been pushing for, but it is a step towards that. So that's progress in my mind. Also, Heather recently wrote a nice piece on Vanguard's active factor ETFs. These are six ETFs covering things like value and momentum. And surprisingly, these just haven't attracted the kind of investor interest you might expect from Vanguard products. Now, I think that's primarily been driven by performance, because basically anything that's not market cap weighted and skewed towards mega cap tech, that's underperformed. But I would say even given that, it's still a bit surprising these haven't garnered more attention. So we'll get into that as well. That'll actually be a perfect segue, because I'll then be joined by Vanguard's head of ETF product management, Rich Powers, and we will talk about that factor ETF lineup and why it has been a bit slow to gain traction. And then we'll also touch on several other topics, including the record flows into bond ETFs and Vanguard's most recent launch, which is an ESG bond ETF. I'm very interested in hearing how Vanguard views ESG investing overall. I haven't covered that before, and Rich is always a tremendous resource, so look forward to that. I'll close this week with Eric Becker, portfolio manager at Water Island Capital. He's going to spotlight the AltShares merger arbitrage ETF. And one of the areas I'm going to discuss with Rich Powers is this narrative around the death of the traditional 60-40 stock bond portfolio, right? That bonds don't yield anything. And so maybe they're just dead weight in a portfolio and you need to look elsewhere. If you believe that, alternative investments are another option. And this merger arbitrage ETF certainly fits the criteria of an alternative investment. So I'll have Eric explain how that strategy works and whether it can be a good fixed income replacement. Again, nice show. Questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci, or you can go to ETFprime.com. Let's start with ETF.com's Heather Bell.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
This is capturing a trend that was already going on. COVID accelerated it. I think there's an uphill battle in bringing this message to investors. We're not going to know if we've hit the saturation point until a year or two after it's happened.
Heather, great having you back on the podcast.
Hi, Nate. Thanks for having me back on.
All right, so you joined me... That was a little over a month ago to cover new ETF launches. And I checked yesterday. Since then, we've now had another nearly 40 ETFs come to market. It was a pretty busy September. And I do love tracking these. So I just thought it'd be fun to get your take on a few of these. And then we can certainly get to your Vanguard piece. Now, I can bet everyone thinks I'm going straight for that SPAC ETF that launched last week. I'm actually saving that. I have the Defiance ETF CEO coming on the podcast later this quarter to spotlight that ETF. I want to start with a newcomer to the ETF market, Simplify ETF. So they launched three ETFs in early September, and these caught my attention because they're unique. They basically invest 98% into IVV, the iShares S&P 500 ETF, and then another 2% into puts and or calls, depending upon the strategy. And the idea is really to profit from tail events in the markets. And I would say if we learned anything this year, it's that those can and do happen. Any quick thoughts on the Simplify ETFs?
I find them very interesting. I think adding in the options strategy is a good way to kind of like create a differentiated fund. We don't have an awful lot of options-based funds on it. It does strike me as being kind of comparable to something like the overlay shares, which do an actively managed portfolio and then an S&P 500 options overlay on top of that.
Well, go ahead.
Sorry. Well, the overlay shares are actually more expensive. The Simplify funds are 28 basis points each, whereas the overlay options are 70 in the ballpark of 75 basis points, but they're also not holding primarily an ETF. They are doing actively managed portfolios.
Well, what I was going to say, I found these interesting because if you think about how popular the defined outcome ETFs have been, you know, I don't think these are comparable, but they're you know, overlaying options on top of IVV. But with the defined outcome ETFs, you have clear upside caps and downside buffers. These ones don't. And if you look at the three ETFs, so there's the Simplify U.S. Equity Plus Convexity ETF. That has 98% in IVV and then the 2% in puts and calls. So you can profit from tail events in either direction. And then the other two ETFs that Simplify launched, the Simplify U.S. Equity Plus Downside Convexity ETF, ticker SPD, that's going to give you a boost in performance during big down moves, right, because it has 2% just in puts. And then the other ETF is a Simplify U.S. Equity Plus Upside Convexity ETF, SPUC. That's going to give you a boost in performance during big up moves because it has 98% in IVV and then 2% calls. But I just find these interesting because the larger the market moves you have in either direction, the larger potential profits, which is where that convexity label comes from. But I'll be interested to see, you know, whether or not these can find an audience. Any thoughts on whether investors will look at these?
I think investors will look at them. If me personally, I would take the word convexity out of their name because that just adds a layer of complication. You really want to keep, as the name of the issuer is, you want to keep things kind of simple. But I think there's a huge demand right now for risk management strategies, and I think these will definitely find some kind of audience.
Yeah, good point on the name, because you're right, not everybody knows what convexity is. But again, I'll be interested to see whether these find an audience. Okay, I also want to ask you about the AdvisorShares Pure U.S. Cannabis ETF, ticker MSOS. And actually, as it turns out, I have the portfolio manager for that ETF coming on the podcast later this quarter as well, Dan Ahrens. But I wanted to bring this up for three reasons. Number one, it's the first ETF focused solely on the U.S. marijuana market. Number two, I thought the timing of this launch was interesting just because marijuana ETFs have really struggled performance-wise, and you don't always see new launches into a struggling space. And then number three, this does hold swaps, which we can get into if you want. But what did you make of this launch?
Well, I think what it is AdvisorShares has a very thesis they believe in very strongly, in which they believe the U.S. cannabis market is going to take off, especially after this upcoming election when they think legalization will become kind of more widespread. This is if I'm recalling my conversations correctly. So they believe there's going to be increased legalization, that you're going to be getting into, with MSOS, you can get into that space like ahead of the legalization that will drive these securities up. So I think what they're doing is they're taking advantage of the fact that YOLO, their global fund, has actually outperformed the dominant fund in the space, MJ, which is issued by ETF Managers Group. So I think it's been outperforming MJ year to date. I think they may be kind of like taking back credibility, pulling the marijuana component out of their ACT fund that trades under the ticker right now, ACT, and just putting that cannabis portion on its own separately to kind of position it to take advantage of that legalization they believe is coming.
No, I agree. And I think if you look at the other marijuana ETFs that are out there, they're all very heavy in Canadian stocks, right?
Yes.
Whereas MSOS, it's really attempting just to get that U.S. exposure, the multi-state operators. I guess the question I have, I mentioned the swaps. Do you think investors care that this ETF holds swaps? Could that scare some investors, or do you think that doesn't matter?
I don't think it will scare the stoners that used to email me demanding to know when the first MJ ETF marijuana ETF would launch. But for slightly more conscientious investors, the swaps could be off-putting. For example, YOLO is outperforming, but I don't think YOLO has a significant allocation to derivatives. MSOS has a allocation to derivatives of nearly 30% of the portfolio, I believe. So that could be off-putting, but if somebody really believes in the U.S. Marijuana market and in its potential, I think they'll take that risk.
Well, and I think to your point, if the regulatory environment shifts, maybe over time this owns less swaps and just holds the underlying, right? And sort of evolves as time goes on. Okay, one other new lineup of ETFs I wanted to get your take on, Natixis. So they launched their first non-transparent active ETFs a few weeks ago, which obviously the non-transparent story continues getting a lot of run.
Yeah.
But Natixis only offered two ETFs prior to this, and they were both transparent active ETFs. And so as I looked at this, I wondered if this is a good example of a company that was maybe just waiting for this non-transparent structure before really making their move into ETFs. And we can certainly talk about Fidelity here in a moment. But do you think that might be the case with Natixis?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. The thing is, mutual funds have kind of been hemorrhaging hemorrhaging assets, and that those assets have been going into ETFs. So I think it was the active mutual fund issuers that were driving a lot of the non-transparent active, promotion. So Natixis has like a pretty large stable of affiliates where they can select funds to promote them. I think, so they took these three, they're all existing mutual funds that have, a nice chunk of assets in under management. And they all come, I believe the range in how much cheaper they are than their mutual fund counterparts is something like 27 to 34 basis points. So you could buy another ETF that could be actively managed or have a complex strategy for the difference in cost with these ETFs.
And these are all using the proxy portfolio structure, right? That Natixis developed with the New York Stock Exchange. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And you're saying these are all, are they exact clones or near clones of the existing mutual funds?
They did not want me using the word clones in the article. I totally get that. But it is the same objectives and the same managers. So I think for all intents and purposes, these are very similar funds, if not identical.
Okay, so that's perfect, because on this note, let's talk about Fidelity. They recently filed to offer their popular Magellan fund in an ETF. If I'm not mistaken, that would be the biggest and probably most well-known equity mutual fund to be offered in an ETF wrapper. Now, it's not the Contra fund that I've been asking for a long time in a transparent wrapper, by the way, but I think this is still a pretty big deal. I actually tweeted out that I think this shows fund companies are finally capitulating, right? They tried fighting against ETFs for so long. In some cases, they flat out ignored ETFs, but I do think they're finally realizing that's a losing strategy longer term. Do you agree with that? And what are your thoughts on this Magellan filing?
Well, I agree with that. I think they're losing assets to ETFs because the ETFs, for everything except retirement, and that part's changing, ETFs are the superior wrapper, in my opinion. I may be biased because I'm an ETF reporter, but, you know. But with the Magellan, I find it interesting because this is like a huge name in the memory of investors, but it's really past its peak. It was a $100 billion fund 20 years ago. Now it's got $27 billion. That's still nothing to sneeze at, but this is a fund that is well off its peak, and they're launching a fund that will probably get some guaranteed assets. I think a lot of the existing investors in it will probably move to the ETF wrapper for future investments. So it's a smart play on their part.
Yeah, you know, the big litmus test here, and we've talked about this in the past, is whether or not investors want active management, period, right? So as we see the Magellan Fund come into an ETF, we talked about Natixis, and we have Legg Mason, American Century, so on and so forth. And if you look at the non-transparent ETFs, it has been a bit of a slow start. That's going to be the question moving forward, because no matter what the wrapper is, that active management is going to at some point have to show outperformance. I think that's going to be the poll. And you mentioned how big this fund was, whatever, 20 years ago. And of course, it was famously managed by Peter Lynch. Do you have to have that? Do you have to have that performance and that star power to pull investors into the fund? And of course, we have a competing subset of products in the quote unquote smart beta or strategic beta, where you have the automation of active management. I think that's going to be fascinating to watch. Now, I was reading, I think it was last week, and Barron said about this Fidelity Magellan filing. They said, quote, could there be a greater symbol of the now $7 trillion ETF industry's ascension? And I do agree with that because, as I mentioned, I think this is an example of fund companies finally capitulating. The question now is whether or not, again, assets will follow.
Oh, yeah. And I also think, active management does have a place in ETFs, but do we need the non-transparent? Because look at what ARK's doing. They are dominating the returns, and they have been for the last few years, and they're doing that with transparent active management.
Yeah, you're going to get me going on that because everybody knows how I feel about that. But I'll never forget talking to Kathy Wood back in 2016, and asking her specifically about that transparent ETF wrapper and whether or not they were concerned with disclosing their holdings every single day. And she was very direct in saying no. They had no concerns about being front run. They prefer to have their picks and their research out in the public, let people beat it up. And it's interesting seeing here today, we fast forward 4 years, the type of success they're having. So I agree, but I do think, I keep saying the same thing, it's going to come down to performance. Okay, on the topic of performance, a few minutes left. Let's get to this piece you wrote on Vanguard's active factor ETFs, which, by the way, as you heard at the top, I will be visiting with Vanguard's Rich Powers here shortly. He may be listening now, so you have to be nice here. But in all seriousness, I thought your piece was interesting because I've tracked these ETFs since they launched in 2018, and I've been a bit surprised by the lack of investor demand. Now, I think we should say that's relative, right? We're talking Vanguard here. So if you look at these products, mm-hmm. they still have like $400 million in assets in total. But do you want to describe what you found? I know you looked at performance. Why do you think these have been somewhat slow to gain traction?
So really, they've got significant loadings to a lot of the funds in the group have significant loadings to the small size factor and to value. And we know those two factors have not been doing that great. But you also kind of think, well, that's what the active management is for. Because they're quantitative funds, but Vanguard's managers do have the ability to go in with discretion and make their own decisions about what the portfolio holds. So there's like, hang on, I have my thoughts here. The momentum and the momentum and the minimum volatility and the quality have a much larger exposure to the low size factor.
Mm-hmm.
than they do to the factor that they're actually targeting. So that, and given that small caps have underperformed, I think that kind of sinks these funds. And then when I looked at the sector allocations, they had smaller allocations to technology. So I think those two things are really what kind of sinks the performance on these. And, you know, I'm a Vanguard fangirl, so I was kind of sad to see that they weren't outperforming.
Do you think that's what it is? I mean, do you think this is performance-driven in terms of, again, the relative light assets in these ETFs? Or do you think there are other factors?
I think there are other factors, too. The fact that Vanguard is primarily known as an index-based investor in the ETF space. I mean, they've got 130-some funds, and I think more than half of those are actively managed. But they are known in the ETF space, at least, and in the mutual fund space to a certain degree, as a primarily index-based investor. So I think people were probably holding back to see what these funds would do, and they haven't done a lot of great stuff yet. And if you wanted to look at the size comparisons, these things are mostly, except for I think one, under $100 million in assets under management. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, I was looking at the average price, average assets in the top issuers, and what I still remember from that little foray into data is that I think the average a few years ago for Vanguard funds was like that they had something like $10 billion in assets, and there wasn't any funds, I don't think, below $5 billion in assets. But that was, I think, when they were primarily focused on the bigger asset classes, and that's, you know, where they had been. They've since kind of like delved into ESG. They've delved into factors, that kind of thing. So those funds are not as in demand as the core asset classes they were covering before. So those are going to be smaller, I guess.
Yeah, I mean,
there's less demand for them.
It's certainly a unique lineup in the Vanguard. You know, when you mention them being primarily known for index-based investing, even though they have a large amount of active funds. But even though these are active, I think really that active component is to give them flexibility in trading. And as I look at these ETFs compared to other factor ETFs out there, you mentioned the small cap tilt. These funds will go across the cap spectrum. And obviously, small cap hasn't been the best place to be, not to mention something like value, right? I think another factor here, too, is just whether or not advisors and investors want that pure factor exposure, that more pure factor exposure. Because if you look at these ETFs compared to some of the other factor ETFs out there, these do have some stronger tilts in places. And perhaps in this environment we've been in, investors just aren't willing to make that commitment. But these will be interesting to watch to me, because I'm sure Vanguard's committed to them. And I'll visit with Rich here in a little bit. I'll be interested to get his thoughts. But in any event, Heather, nice job this week. Enjoyed having you back on the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
It was great to be here. Thanks for having me, Nate.
That was ETF.com's Heather Bell. My next guest is Rich Powers, head of ETF product management at Vanguard, who currently offers 81 ETFs, nearly $1.3 trillion invested in the U.S. That includes their most recently launched ETF, the Vanguard ESG U.S. Corporate Bond ETF, which we will be discussing. And I should also note, Vanguard has had a monster year in terms of flows into their ETFs, around $133 billion, which that nearly equals the inflows for the next 9 ETF issuers combined. That stat courtesy of Morningstar's Ben Johnson. Of course, Vanguard is currently the country's second largest ETF issuer overall. And Rich is now joining me via phone from Pennsylvania. Rich, always enjoy having you on the podcast. Thanks for taking the time.
Nate, thanks for having me again.
Okay, so you joined me earlier in the year after the market turmoil in March. And you may recall, we spent a lot of time discussing bond ETFs. And I actually want to pick up on that conversation because since we last spoke, investors have continued pouring money into these products. So as we sit here today, bond ETF flows are right around their annual record, which that was set last year, about $156, $157 billion. That includes both U.S. and international bond ETFs. And of course, we still have 3 months to go. To begin, what are you seeing from your perspective? I know when we last spoke, you mentioned the powerful endorsement of bond ETFs from the Fed. Has this primarily been Fed-driven, or are there other factors at play here?
Well, when you look at the actual cash flows into fixed income ETFs this year, and then you look at the Fed's activity in their balance sheet, which, by the way, they publish at the end of every month, what you see is that the Fed actually has done very little buying in terms of fixed income ETFs over the course of the second quarter in particular. And in fact, they've not bought fixed income ETFs in the last 2 months. However, I think the signal there was that for investors, you know, the Fed, a discerning buyer, clearly looked at fixed income ETFs as a way to access the fixed income market in an efficient manner, in a low cost manner, in a diversified manner. And I think that was, you know, partly kind of opened up some investors' eyes to say, you know what, this is the type of instrument that I want to use to build my portfolios, to construct a targeted fixed income allocation. I think one really kind of interesting stat to kind of think about here, like if you just looked at our intermediate term corporate fixed income ETF as an example, VCIT, the spread on that product is about 1 basis point. If you went out and tried to buy those underlying bonds using kind of a Bloomberg Barclays liquidity cost score, it would cost you about 40 basis points. So obviously there's the expense ratio with an ETF as well, but in this case it's very low at 5 bps. So the efficiency, the cost advantages that exist in the fixed income ETF are really powerful for Joe and Jane Smith investor all the way up to an institutional investor like an insurance company.
And of course the Fed. And I guess along with that, if you look back at the market crisis in March, Do you think it's possible that may have actually helped instill confidence in bond ETF investors, not because the Fed ended up coming in, but because the ETF structure itself held up? Do you think investors looked back and said, hey, bond ETFs have been through the wars, they've come out the other side, and so that's, you know, instills that confidence to hold those vehicles longer term?
I think that's part of it, Nate. Certainly, you know, I think overall we give ETFs very much a high passing grade in terms of how they navigated the turmoil in March and April. But I think the other thing you kind of need to keep in mind here is when you have these kind of big market events, it allows individual investors, advisors, institutions to step back and say, you know, I've been waiting to make certain changes in my portfolio, either moving from an active strategy to a passive strategy or investing more internationally in fixed income than I have historically. It actually gives investors that chance to think about their portfolio in a different manner. And so I suspect part of it was kind of the opportunity was unlocked to reconsider maybe long-term strategic allocations that investors had wanted to kind of move towards, but, you know, for whatever reason, be it tax considerations or other reasons, hadn't got around to. And so I think fixed income ETFs are a beneficiary there. And you can't argue against the power of kind of rebalancing that's happening here, right, with the big drawdown that we saw in March, only to be followed by a strong rally in equities thereafter. You know, when if an investor is being disciplined about their asset allocation, they're going to naturally move into more fixed income subsequent to that. And yeah, I think fixed income ETFs are on the receiving end.
No, that's a great point regarding the rebalancing. It's just interesting to me because if we go back to March and you think about all the media headlines around bond ETF discounts, and now we fast forward here 6-7 months later, we're on a record pace for bond ETFs, will likely shatter that annual number. It's just such an interesting dichotomy. I'm curious, as you look at the growth of bond ETFs overall, are you seeing any distinction between the growth of index-based ETFs and active ETFs? Or even if you look at mutual funds, you see any distinction there between index-based and active?
Yeah, I think maybe the key distinction, if we stay in the ETF lane, would be the significant rise of active fixed income ETFs. And if you kind of boil it down, really, it's at the ultra short end of the yield curve. So there's a number of active strategies that have been launched over the last handful of years that kind of sit in this, call it, 1 year duration or less. And it's not surprising that more investors are thinking about those types of asset allocations, given where rates are and where rates are expected to be. And so you're seeing a little bit more diversity in terms of the active-passive split in fixed income than, say, you're seeing in the equity side, though, as we both know, there's no shortage of new active equity non-transparent ETFs that are coming to market. The cash flows just haven't materialized in the same way they have in the active fixed income ultra-short space.
Rich, when you mentioned asset allocation, this actually brings up an interesting topic, because even though we are seeing record flows into bond ETFs, one of the narratives out there right now, which I'm sure you've seen, is the quote-unquote death of the traditional 60-40 stock bond portfolio, right? That because bonds aren't yielding much, perhaps investors need to look elsewhere for that 40%. Now, I can guess where you're going to land on this topic, but I'm going to ask you anyway, do you have any strong views on this narrative that's out there?
I think it's natural for investors, pundits, whoever, to want to kind of pick at some long-held maxims, and 60-40 is as conventional a maxim as you heard out there in terms of how to build a portfolio. But we also have like history as a guide to look at and say, well, those same critiques have happened in years past, right? I've been in this business now for more than 20 years, and I've heard the critique of the 60-40 asset allocation not being long for the future in terms of delivering outcomes for investors. But the discipline that exists within that type of strategy and the results suggest that, you know, those suggestions that that asset allocation is long in the tooth, you know, feel like a little worn in my view.
Do you have any thoughts regarding that balance between bonds as a ballast in a portfolio versus bonds is a yield or income producing instrument? How you balance that risk reward equation?
Yeah, I think when you think about generating income from an investor standpoint, I think the long held belief is you generate that income from your fixed income portfolio. But we've suggested for some time now that is one way to do it, but there is maybe a more elegant way to generate income for a portfolio, and that's to, from a rebalancing standpoint, using your equity portfolio to generate some of that income. And so, if you look at kind of the most important role a fixed income allocation plays in a asset allocation, it is that ballast, right? We see that time and time again when you have dramatic equity drawdowns, that the volatility that exists in fixed income is materially different, and it has behavioral benefits in terms of allowing investors to stay invested and not make dramatic shifts. And so, income can be generated in a variety of different ways, including kind of harvesting kind of gains from the equity portion of your portfolio. And so, thinking of fixed income's value only residing with the income generating component of it, I think is a little bit short-sighted and narrow.
No, I completely agree. I mean, my fear is investors start moving into riskier segments of the market, and then when things don't go so well, they have, you know, greater exposure to the downside than maybe what they were otherwise expecting. I mean, I saw over the weekend, again, Barron's, they had a headline, a 60-40 stock bond strategy doesn't work. What to do instead? That was the title of the article. And I think maybe a better way to think about this is have lower return expectations moving forward. I think a lot of investors don't want to hear that, but that very well may be the environment we're in as you look out over the next 10, 15, 20 years, because I think yields are certainly the starting yields you have in your investments. That's a good indication of what your returns are going to be down the road. And so I think considering things like saving more money will have a greater impact. I just worry about investors chasing that yield and taking on more risk. In any event,
go ahead. Yeah. Just two thoughts here. One would be, if it doesn't work, I would suggest that maybe the investors take a look at the balanced index fund. Vanguard Balanced Index Fund is just a proxy, right? It's a 60-40 equity to fixed income allocation. We can see whether it's worked or not, and I think the answer is yes, it has. So I'm skeptical of kind of that type of critique, because the data would tell you otherwise.
All right. In terms of potential bond ETF options, I do want to talk about Vanguard's most recent launch. And I always think these are newsworthy just because Vanguard is so meticulous with new launches. They just don't happen every day. And so a couple of weeks ago, you rolled out the Vanguard ESG U.S. Corporate Bond ETF, ticker symbol VCEB. This actually adds to your ESG ETF lineup, by the way. You also offer the Vanguard ESG U.S. Stock ETF, ticker ESGV, and the Vanguard ESG International Stock ETF, ticker VSGX. Tell us about this new ESG Corporate Bond ETF and some background on why you launched it.
Sure. So in 2018, as you mentioned, we launched those two equity ETFs. And at the time, you know, our view was, definitely as we're kind of building out our offer, because we're hearing more and more from a variety of clients that we serve, that we want to have a fixed income offering. However, given the nascence of the marketplace, it wasn't necessarily the top priority for us to launch. But over the last couple of years, we've done a lot of survey work. We've talked to a lot of clients, and we've done a ton of research on our own in terms of how we would build an ESG fixed income portfolio on behalf of our clients. And it became very evident to us that starting with a U.S. fixed income allocation is where clients are today and would have the greatest value in terms of allowing investors to put the lion's share of their where the lion's share of their fixed income allocation is. We looked at a variety of different structures, but in the end landed on an investment grade corporate bond ETF, and it largely reflected the fact that for government agency mortgages, sovereign debt, there isn't a conventional way to screen those companies out from an ESG perspective. When you think about the normal conventional approach to screening of removing companies who are involved in alcohol, tobacco, firearms, fossil fuels. And so that led us to focus on corporate bonds. And here we're talking about a starting universe of all investment-grade corporate bonds in the U.S., removing those companies and those in the businesses I mentioned before, and then the net portfolio is the market cap weighted residual of all of that. It gives you a significant amount of coverage in the corporate bond market, allows you to invest with your preferences, and does it in a very low cost manner.
Rich, as I mentioned, Vanguard has been very meticulous with new launches. And I should also note, you've never closed an ETF as well, which is a remarkable stat. But when I see a commitment to ESG from somebody like Vanguard, that certainly gets my attention, especially because, quite frankly, I'm someone who's been somewhat skeptical of the value of ESG investing overall. Can you talk more about why Vanguard does view ESG as a real, sustainable, longer-term investment trend?
Sure. I mean, you have to think about kind of our approach to product development, and that approach is anchored in, is there an investment case for the product? Is there a business case, i.e., is there someone, clients who are desiring it? Can we do it well, and can we do it low cost? And so thinking about our ESG build-out over the last couple of years, there's certainly been a growing demand from a variety of clients that we serve, and their preferences want their preferences reflected in their portfolios. And we've done academic work on this. We've reviewed studies to see is ESG a factor that adds alpha to a portfolio, or does it detract from it? And the results are inconclusive. The studies are all over the map. And so our view is this is not about a means to outperform or underperform, rather to deliver very specific exposure to those clients. I know there's some in the industry who are out there saying this is a alpha-generating strategy, be it an index version or an active version. That's certainly not our critique. It's a way to invest that, based upon how different the underlying index is from the broad market, you'll take on tracking error relative to that alternative non-ESG weighted portfolio.
Just to expand on that, though, so if this isn't viewed as an alpha-generating opportunity or perhaps even to reduce risk, I just want to be clear, is this for investors to be able to do better for society, or is it to reflect their values? Like, what is the value of taking an ESG approach?
It's largely to reflect their values, right? So there is a cohort of investors, and that's saying it's for every investor. It's a way to invest for a certain subset of investors that would allow them to put their capital to work in bonds or equities, which companies that they feel align with their values, and omit those companies from where they don't want their capital invested in companies that are involved in certain areas of the market, be it fossil fuels or alcohol and tobacco. And so this is very much around preferences and values aligning for that certain subset of investors.
Okay, only a few minutes left here. I do want to make sure to ask you about your six active factor ETFs, because I discussed these earlier with ETF.com's Heather Bell. She recently wrote a piece on these. And I guess, again, going back to how meticulous Vanguard is with new ETF launches, these six ETFs debuted back in 2018, a couple years ago. And compared to your other ETFs, these just haven't found the audience from investors yet. But obviously, you wouldn't have launched these if you didn't think that audience would materialize. Now, from my perspective, I think it's clear one of the main reasons for this lower start has been performance, right? The fact is, anything other than a market cap weighted, mega cap tech focused approach has probably underperformed. But I think some might say these ETFs are a bit outside of what people would expect from Vanguard. They're not an index-based approach or even traditional active management. I would just love to get your take on this factor ETF lineup and what you think the future might hold with these.
Sure. Great question. I definitely took a look at Heather's article as well. I think first I would say the factor lineup that we launched is an extension of what we've been doing for years. We've had traditional active. We've had quantitative active. And our quantitative equity group, who manages these portfolios, runs north of $30 billion in client assets for us and has been doing that for more than 25 years. And so there's a long history there. This is a different packaging of that capability, but nevertheless, it's built on something that has a lot of history. In terms of the challenges that we've had in terms of adoption of these products, we knew this would be challenging. We were doing something very different than the rest of the industry. We were offering these products as active strategies, whereas the conventional smart beta, strategic beta was packaged in an index strategy. And two, we were doing it in a all-cap portfolio, so large, mid, and small, whereas most of the competitive products are large-cap. The reason why we felt active was compelling is it really revolves around the ability to rebalance our portfolio to that ideal state of value exposure, momentum exposure, rather than waiting for a quarterly rebalance or semi-annual rebalance when we know a decay happens. And the reason why we believe all cap is a better approach is because the factor exists across the entire cap spectrum, not just large cap. And in fact, there could be an argument made that the exposure may be more pronounced in mid and small cap. And so we wanted to give that investor that total solution if they wanted to tilt their portfolio towards that factor. Obviously, when we make those decisions, our portfolios end up being higher tracking error relative to a conventional market cap weighted benchmark or even just a conventional style-based benchmark like a value index. And so there is a little bit more due diligence and a little bit more what I call fortitude an investor would have to have in order to come to conclude that they want to make the allocation and then stick with it, because the ride you get because you have a fully loaded exposure to the factor is going to be a little bit more volatile.
And see, I wonder if that's ultimately, why these have been a bit slow out of the gate is because they do have that higher tracking error. And I wonder if in this environment, investors maybe don't have the fortitude to take that on and stick with that longer term. I guess any thoughts on that? Because as you mentioned, these are all cap. And so it is going to be a different ride. So what type of investor are these products really geared towards?
Yeah, our view is definitely they're for a sophisticated investor who is willing to do the due diligence up front and willing to understand the risk they're taking on and kind of ride that out in the long term. We know active strategies in general the payoff to active strategies, if there is one, takes a long time. And so right now we're in a period of time where the exposures, particularly small cap and value as an example, have been really out of favor for some significant period of time. And the consequence of that is that the performance of our portfolios looks pretty out of step. But if you believe in the exposure, and if you want to make a small allocation to reflect a view that value has attractive qualities from a portfolio construction standpoint, or momentum does, that these portfolios will give you kind of one of the purest ways in order to access that in the marketplace.
Well, Rich, I always appreciate the insight and the candidness. Congratulations on the ESG bond ETF launch and really the great year for Vanguard ETF so far in terms of flows. Look forward to chatting again soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Nate.
That was Rich Powers, head of ETF product management at Vanguard. My last guest this week is Eric Becker, portfolio manager at Water Island Capital. They're behind the AltShares Merger Arbitrage ETF, ticker symbol ARB, ARB, that's just launched in May, and Eric is now on the line with me from New York. Eric, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Nate. I appreciate the opportunity to join.
All right, so this is the first ETF launched under the AltShares brand. I know Water Island Capital has been around for 20-plus years. Tell us a little bit about the decision to enter the ETF space and perhaps about Water Island Capital itself.
Yes, thanks again, Nate. It's an exciting time for the firm. And just for a bit of additional background on myself and my role in creating the investable index and as portfolio manager for the AltShares Merger Arbitrage ETF, it was really born out of my 10 years of experience working as a senior analyst alongside our investment team at Water Island Capital. And Water Island Capital is an event-driven boutique investment advisor that was founded in the year 2000. So like you mentioned, we're proudly celebrating our 20-year anniversary as a firm. We manage approximately $2.3 billion across mutual funds, private investment vehicles, separately managed accounts. And with the launch of the AltShares Merger Arbitrage ETF, we have entered the ETF space. The ticker for the passive rules-based ETF is ARB, ARB, which was listed on the New York Stock Exchange on May 7th. It's the first in a new line of event-driven ETFs that we'll be making available to investors under that AltShares brand. You know, the creation and the development of AltShares has been ongoing for several years, and it became a priority for our team at Water Island because our clients and really the general investment community, Nate, came to us and they were expressing an interest in a passive pure play merger arbitrage strategy that could take advantage of those tax efficiencies, the transparency, and the daily liquidity that ETFs provide and have become so popular for. So as a firm, we've made significant investments in technology, our software engineering capabilities, as well as our risk management team. So we're very confident that the investments that we have made across the firm in terms of personnel and technology, coupled with our 20 years of experience managing event-driven strategies, has really put us in a position to successfully launch this ETF and other event-driven strategies in an ETF wrapper in the near future. And I will stress the fact that we are a small boutique investment firm and are truly client-focused, so we've made it a priority to be wrapper agnostic when it comes to providing event-driven strategies to our clients. So the creation and development of the AltShares brand is also about providing our clients with the option to use the investment vehicle they prefer to have exposure to in their portfolios.
Well, Eric, let's get to the ETF. So this is a global merger arbitrage strategy, and I think probably best to first have you explain what that strategy is, and then you can certainly walk through the ETF construction. Do you want to explain what a global merger arbitrage strategy entails?
Sure, Nate. That's a great place to start. The ETF, the AltShares Merger Arbitrage ETF, employs a pure play merger arb strategy, like I mentioned earlier, which means we're solely investing in definitive publicly announced mergers and acquisitions. Each of the securities that populate the portfolio have agreed to and signed a definitive merger agreement that has contractually obligated the buyer and the seller to the deal. I like to stress this because some investors can be misled by funds that claim to be merger arb funds. What in fact they are more event-driven or special situation funds, because these funds are also investing in speculative transactions or aren't completely hedging out all the external market risk factors. Those factors include hedging the acquiring company stock in transactions where the deal value or consideration is to be paid in stock, or hedging currency exposure in deals where the deal value is subject to currency risk. For a pure play merger arb fund like ARB is, we isolate the profit opportunity to the deal spread, which is the difference between the price at which the target company in a transaction currently trades and the price the acquiring company agreed to pay to complete the deal. So once a transaction is announced, the shares of the target company tend to trade not in line with broader market movements, but rather in line with the fundamentals of the deal. So when executed properly, the strategy should provide an absolute return stream with low correlation and low beta to the broader equity and credit markets, with low volatility and a strong capital preservation characteristics. And I'll stop there before digging into the methodology.
Well, yeah, you mentioned the deal spread. Can you expand on why that exists?
Yes, of course. The spread on any individual merger deal is primarily comprised of deal risk, which is the risk that the transaction may fail to complete. So those factors include regulatory risk, financing, shareholder votes, and an additional factor is the time value of money, which is impacted by the risk-free rate and the expected timing to close, which is controlled by the approvals required to complete the transaction. So you may see a deal close in 45 days if it's a short-duration tender offer that only requires Department of Justice approval in the United States, and you don't see a lot of overlap between the two companies. However, you may see a deal remain outstanding for 12 to 15 months, like we will see with the Fitbit-Google transaction, where they're getting they're under a lot of scrutiny, not only from the U.S. regulators, but also from the regulators overseas. So we have deals that also have to go through the European Union or the EU approval process or the Chinese regulatory approval process. And those processes, not only do they not provide a lot of transparency to investors, but they take time. And that has to be taken into consideration when you're looking at the deal risk or the spread or the profit opportunity for a merger arbitrage.
Okay, so explain exactly how your ETF, ARB, how is it executing this merger arbitrage strategy? What does it hold?
Right. So our first step is defining the deal universe. And I should also point out that this process is done in-house by our indexing team alongside Solactive, who acts as the fund's index calculation agent. So our screen process begins with the inclusion of deals in North America and Europe. The second step is identifying transactions that are complete takeovers. We do not participate in partial or majority takeovers. The acquiring company must be acquiring 100% of the target. The minimum deal size that's eligible for inclusion is $200 million, and we only invest in positive deal spreads. We do not invest and will sell any deal that trades through the deal terms, which is also referred to as a negative spread. And then any deal that has been outstanding for greater than 365 days is not eligible for inclusion. And that is based on our investment team's experience and 20 years of data and a ton of academic research that we have compiled. And we have found that the risk reward for deals that are pending for greater than 365 days are at a greater risk of a deal break. So we have opted to eliminate any exposure to deals that get extended beyond 365 days.
And how many holdings total?
Yeah, so we hold roughly 30 deals. And the way that we get to those 30 deals is the next step in our process includes applying security constraints. So that will help shape the composition, the number of positions, and the position sizes of the deals in the fund. And it's important to point out that our team's 20 years of experience managing merger arb portfolios is really at the core of the ETF. And it's very apparent when you dig into the index's methodology and the strict risk management processes that have been implemented. And I'll just provide an example. We've developed a formula that risk adjusts position weights based on potential losses for each individual deal. So without getting too far into the weeds, what that means is the index is calculating a downside for each individual position in the portfolio. That's opposed to focusing solely on liquidity to size positions or simply equal weighting each deal in the portfolio. So this is a clear differentiator, and we've seen the benefits of our unique risk rules in just a few short months the ETF has been launched. And then probably most importantly, I'll mention our rebalancing strategy, because during the pandemic, it really benefited us that we constructed the methodology of the ETF to rebalance twice monthly versus monthly or quarterly, like you would see with most, if not all, other ETFs. You know, this has allowed us to take advantage of the volatility. You know, the ETF did make buys opportunistically in spreads that widened out the idiosyncratic levels during the pandemic. But we also had situations where the implied probability of a transaction closing got to a level where it triggered a risk constraint to reduce the position size. So our philosophy, our approach, and the way we constructed the underlying index for the ETF is really driven by how our firm over two decades has consistently employed the strategy, which is much different than how any other passive ETF is managed. And that's in its purest fashion. When executed properly, like I mentioned earlier, the strategy should provide a return stream with low correlation and low volatility.
Eric, in terms of using this ETF in a portfolio, I was actually visiting earlier with Vanguard's Rich Powers, and we talked about whether the traditional 60-40 portfolio is dead because bonds are yielding next to nothing right now. And his perspective was that, and I think I align with this as a whole, that no, you know, bonds are supposed to be a ballast in a portfolio. It's not always all about yield. And you don't have to speak directly to that, but I do know because bond yields are so low, there is a case to be made for alternative investments like this merger arbitrage ETF. Can you just talk about that, why this strategy might make sense in this environment as a fixed income replacement?
Yeah, Nathan, it's very, very topical for us and our clients, and we've had a lot of prospective client calls because of that reason as a fixed income alternative. And I would agree with that assessment. And the AllShares merger arbitrage ETF specifically has many different uses due to its risk-reward profile and its non-correlated nature. You know, one of the strategy's most common uses is a portfolio diversifier, particularly as a fixed income alternative. So this is, you know, the structure of a merger arbitrage trade is actually quite similar to a zero coupon bond, which is purchased at a discount and pays its face value upon maturity. An arbitrageur or ETF purchases a target company at a discount to the deal value and receives the deal value upon the completion of the merger. But unlike bonds, however, rates of return in the merger arbitrage strategy have historically benefited from rising interest rates. So the strategy could also be included in a client's portfolio to hedge out inflation risk. But like I said earlier, when it's executed properly, it is a great fixed income alternative. And during times of market stress like we have been experiencing, when fixed income isn't as attractive, merger arbitrage is a very attractive strategy for investors.
What's the biggest risk here? So if investors do consider this as a fixed income replacement, if you look at the overall risk return profile, what could go wrong?
Well, what could go wrong is you know, a theme that we have been seeing is, and we have deals going into litigation within the portfolio. What could go wrong is broken deals. And that's why it's so important when I outline the risk constraints and the rigorous, you know, rules and risk management we have around the portfolio. Because if a deal breaks in a number of situations, let's just take Tiffany's, for example. Tiffany's is a 135 deal that's currently on the table with Louis Vuitton. The stock currently trades at 117. And the downside could potentially be around $65 to $70 a share based on sell-side analysts and in our internal valuation work that we have fundamentally done. So the risk is in broken deals. And when you go through a pandemic like we did in March and April and May, and you have a transaction that was inked in late 2019, the attractiveness of that asset to Louis Vuitton may not be as, you know, it may not make the same amount of sense from a strategic perspective as it did when they purchased the asset in November. So broken deals in the portfolio is obviously a risk that we have to undertake in the portfolio, and it's probably the significant risk that we have. However, it's about taking into consideration, like we have within our rules, where we're sizing each and every position based on the downside. So we know that there's significant downside in Tiffany's, and we're taking no greater than 2% of NAV risk in any situation. But when you have a deal such as Tiffany's and Louis Vuitton, when it's trading at such a low probability to close, we're also taking that into consideration, and we're even putting more stringent risk constraints on that position, given the way that the market is trading that situation.
Eric, just about 2 minutes left before I let you go. A pending deal that I know most of our listeners are probably familiar with is the Charles Schwab acquisition of TD Ameritrade, which doesn't look like it's going to be a broken deal. Do you mind just explaining how that's playing out in this ETF? Maybe go through the entire life cycle from adding this deal to the ETF to what happens when it formally closes, which is today, right?
That's correct. It closed this morning. It actually closed at 12:02 a.m. this morning, and it was delisted before the open. But the Schwab's acquisition of TD Ameritrade is a great example. That really is a textbook merger arb trade and very topical, like you're saying, given the acquisition closed this morning. Now, this was a $25 billion deal that was announced on November 21st of 2019. So one of the first things you'll notice about this transaction is it was a 10-month deal, which is quite a bit longer than what we usually experience in regards to the duration of a transaction that the ETF will hold. Just for reference, the average duration of a deal in the ETF at the end of September was 82 days. But the investment team process starts with a press release that is publicly announced by both TD Ameritrade and Schwab, which provides us as shareholders and investors with the terms of the transaction, an estimated closing date, and other high-level details, and we'll usually pick that up on our Bloomberg terminals. The terms for this particular transaction, as a TD Ameritrade shareholder, when the deal closes, I'm going to receive 1.0837 shares, which we refer to as the deal ratio or the stock terms of Schwab, which represented a 16% premium for TD Ameritrade shareholders. So as a pure play merger arbitrage fund, to capture the deal spread and eliminate any market exposure, the ETF initiated a long position in TD Ameritrade and then went short 1.0837 shares of Schwab for every long TD Ameritrade share to lock in that deal spread. The spread upon the announcement of this particular deal was trading around roughly $2.20. So the spread or profit opportunity was $2.20, which represented a 5.3% annualized rate of return. So that spread or profit opportunity, like we talked about, is driven by the perceived risk of the deal closing and timing to close. At the time of this deal's announcement, pre-COVID, during a very strong market last year, a 5.3% annualized return was slightly higher than a typical merger arbitrage spread. So you can see merger arbitrage investors wanted to get paid in excess of a typical spread because of the regulatory risk and the longer duration for this deal to close. So as this deal progressed over the first few months, the spread continued to trade in that 4.5% to 5.5% annualized range. Now, typically, you would see the spread grind tighter as other deals close and money is redeployed into existing deals. However, it was the impact of COVID and the fact that the Department of Justice had some market share concerns in this particular deal, it caused the spread to trade at wider levels. And that was really due to the fact that Ameritrade is the number two discount broker. Schwab is the number one discount broker. So the requests for additional information and the extended review by the regulators continued to keep this spread wide. Then we saw the spread get cut to 30 cents. So from $2.20, you saw the spread collapse to 30 cents on June 6th, which was the day the deal received regulatory approval from the Department of Justice, which was considered to be the riskiest of the approvals for this transaction. So that only left the Federal Reserve as the last outstanding approval, and the banks received that approval last week, which caused the spread to trade from a minimal spread in that roughly 20 to 30 cent range to parity, because the deal had become riskless with all the approvals in and the shareholders were simply awaiting today's delisting. This has been a top holding for the ETF and a top contributor for the ETF for the third quarter. Our methodology identified this deal, as a spread with a high probability of closing, an attractive return opportunity, and a deal that didn't have a tremendous amount of downside. So this has been a core holding for the ETF, as was Morgan Stanley's acquisition of E-Trade, which was another deal in the discount brokerage sector that closed last week.
Yeah, the Charles Schwab deal, though, that really is a perfect example of a merger arbitrage strategy. Eric, we're going to have to leave it there. Congratulations on the launch. Certainly wish you success. Thank you for joining me this week.
Thanks again for having me on the podcast. We're looking forward optimistically to the opportunity and the journey that lies ahead for AltShares, and we look forward to updating you as we grow.
Thank you. That was Eric Becker, portfolio manager at Water Island Capital. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, iShares. You can visit iShares.com to learn more about their investment strategies. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can send comments through etfprime.com. Next week, I'll be joined by Andrew Channon, CEO of Procure AM. We're going to chat about his Procure Space ETF And then I'm also going to throw a bunch of rapid-fire questions at Andrew on broader ETF topics. And then Andrew Rodriguez, CEO and Chief Investment Officer of Change Finance, will spotlight their U.S. large-cap fossil fuel-free ETF and also discuss the case for ESG investing. Until then, have a great week, everyone.